you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
From the Mound Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. May Martinez, a UCLA professor, studied small businesses in six LA neighborhoods to find out how they're holding up during the pandemic. How do you think Venice, Sherman Oaks, and Larchmont compare to Chinatown, Boyle Heights, and Leimert Park? Well, it turns out there was a big difference in the financial health of the small businesses in those two groups. Find out what that difference is ahead on Take Two. Stay with us.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Thanks for joining us. Coming up,
We can look around at our committee in person or on Zoom and understand that Hollywood clearly does not get what we are.
Indigenous screenwriters pen an open letter to the industry demanding more inclusion and better representation. Plus, there is a flex alert in effect starting in 1 hour. We'll tell you all about it just ahead. But first, COVID-19 has hit small businesses very hard. Last week, we talked about independent bookstores around Los Angeles, many of them longtime fixtures in their neighborhoods that are on the brink of closure. Thankfully, customers have been rallying to their cause, but mom-and-pop shops and eateries everywhere are on the precipice, prompting LA Times' Steve Lopez to declare in his column that, quote, "the Los Angeles we love is dying in 2020. UCLA professor Paul Ong has been tracking small businesses in LA and has found that those in certain neighborhoods are faring worse than others. He's the director of the university's Center for Neighborhood Knowledge. Professor Ong, you compared the economic health of small businesses in six LA neighborhoods. Tell us about that.
Our analysis looks at businesses, small businesses, non-chain businesses in six neighborhoods, also comparing it to the county as a whole. So we have three predominantly ethnic neighborhoods, historical ethnic neighborhoods, Boyle Heights, Chinatown, and Leimert Park. So the other three are Sherman Oaks, Larchmont Village, and Venice. Overall, compared to the county as a whole, ethnic neighborhoods are performing worse. They've been hit harder, and we suspect that it will have long-term effects.
And what metrics did you use to compare these neighborhoods?
We use essentially what's called big data. This is smartphone data, locational data. And we looked at the number of pedestrians going to the shops in these neighborhoods. And we were able to track them from January until the summer. And our main metrics is comparing the amount of traffic this year compared to a year ago. Chinatown is the neighborhood that was hit the hardest and the earliest. And we think it's due to the xenophobic reaction that was coming out of the White House. In terms of Boyle Heights, it also declined earlier, but stabilized, performing roughly where the county is performing as a whole. We suspect part of the latter stage is due to the medical facilities nearby operating because of the pandemic. And so they had a spillover effect. In terms of Leimert Park, we find that, again, like some of these other neighborhoods, they were hit hard and earlier before the lockdown. Leimert Park, however, during the lockdown, continued to operate at a low but still operating level. And we suspect partly it's because in that neighborhood, they became essential businesses, that the residents had fewer options, and therefore they went to these stores.
wondering, Professor, the businesses in Boyle Heights, Chinatown, and Leimert Park, generally how much assistance did they get from the government? How much of those PPP loans did they get?
We suspect that under PPP, minority neighborhoods got disproportionately less. In a separate study where we looked at where the money was flowing, and we compare by zip codes, different neighborhoods, the neighborhoods that received the least amount of funds were disproportionately minority, disproportionately low income. And when we looked at the data for those three areas, compared to other areas, they were getting less support overall, fewer dollars to save jobs.
For Boyle Heights and Chinatown, Professor, wondering if there was any obstacles that businesses in those neighborhoods had to overcome when reaching out for help, maybe cultural or language barriers.
You identified two of the main ones, that there's cultural and linguistic barriers. But beyond that, many of these businesses started off marginalized, meaning that they did not have the connection to the financial institutions that other businesses had. And consequently, because the money flew through the banks, these businesses in these communities did not have the connections nor the technical support to apply for financial assistance.
And going back to Chinatown for a second, Professor, I mean, we mentioned the xenophobia that that existed for these businesses even before really COVID-19 really struck and started impacting the area. How much help do they still need with that? Are they still dealing with those kinds of issues to try and keep their businesses afloat?
I think the continued rhetoric racializes a problem we have, and we don't need to do that. And continuing to use terms that are ethnic and racial has hit Chinatowns, as well as some other Asian American enclaves, very hard.
We're talking to Paul Ong, UCLA professor and director of the University Center for Neighborhood Knowledge. Professor, with all of this going on, and now it's kind of a little depressing to know that these businesses in these particular areas are struggling a lot more than some other areas in LA. What might the city look like when the pandemic finally ends, or if the pandemic continues with no end in sight?
Hopefully there's a second wave of stimulus support. And if there is, I think it's absolutely necessary that politicians, policymakers recognize that some neighborhoods are being hit harder and that we prioritize the support for these neighborhoods. If we do so, then the damages will be less. If we fail to do so, many of these neighborhoods, particularly people of color, lower income neighborhoods, will lose whatever economic base they have. They already started off with having fewer jobs. These are job poor neighborhoods. These are neighborhoods that are food deserts. These are neighborhoods that don't have the diversity of retailing. And they will suffer. And if that's gone, even the weak economic base they had before the pandemic will become even weaker.
You know, I mentioned that when the call went out last month that independent bookstores such as Roman's in Pasadena were hurting, customers responded and bought books. And there's been a call all over the city to support certain kinds of businesses. With so many of these businesses you're talking about on the edge, Professor, what more can be done to help and how do we get there?
I think it's great that the public is stepping up to help these small businesses. And we need to continue to do that, but we need to think more systematically. We need to think about the whole structure of support. And again, I think what we need to do in our policies is build in an equitable component. That is, we need to first understand who's being hurt more. And then we need to figure out policies and funding to make sure that those who are most at risk, those who are hurt the most, receive the most support.
Professor, you think we should be legitimately worried that the character of our city will change almost to the point where it can't be repaired. If these mom and pop businesses in these ethnic neighborhoods can't survive and they get replaced by big brand stores or big brand chains, how will LA change?
There's no question Los Angeles is going to change regardless. The question is, what type of change? What do we care about? And if we do care about our cultural ethnic diversity, we care that it is important to have these cultural institutions that reflects our heritage as an immigrant society. Then we have to step in and make plans and policies to try to preserve that. So change will happen regardless. The question is, what type of change and what are we willing to do?
That's Paul Ong, UCLA professor and director of the University Center for Neighborhood Knowledge. Professor, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Over the past few months since school has gone online, we've checked in with high school students to hear how the new dynamic has changed how they learn and how they socialize. We've also heard from teachers of all levels to find out how being an educator is different now. Well, next, we'll hear from the people in the middle of it all, how parents are dealing with distance learning. That's next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on kpcc.org. I'm E. Martinez. We're now more than 6 weeks into the new school year, with online learning still the norm for most students. Parents continue, though, to be put through that ringer, trying to figure out how to best help their kids. But some hope is on the horizon. LA County is now accepting waivers from schools that hope to reopen to teach at least some students in person. And more than 140 schools in the Los Angeles Unified School District have notified public health officials of their intent to provide that in-person support to its kids. But so far, LA Unified and the teachers union, United Teachers Los Angeles, have only agreed to one-on-one tutoring for special needs students. So to help us understand how some families have been dealing with all of this, we turn to two moms we've spoken to in the past. Vicky Martinez, mother of four boys, all attending LA Unified Schools in Highland Park. And Priya Balsen, she has a daughter and a son going to school in the Long Beach Unified School District. Vicky, let's start with you on this. So because you have four sons, all in different grade levels at LAUSD schools, two who require specialized services. How's the school year been going for you so far?
My two oldest with IEPs, I think, are doing well. Their school has reached out. I know who to contact if I have any questions, any concerns. My concern is with my younger ones. They don't have IEPs yet, and they're struggling. And they have a lot of screen time and a lot of work. And there's one of me for two of them. So it's really, really difficult. And this isn't including when my older ones need help, even though they're pretty self-sufficient during the day, that, you know, they could go from class to class and complete most of their tasks. They still need help here and there. And like I said, there's one of me for all of them during the school day.
Vicky, you mentioned IEPs. What are IEPs?
So IEP is a plan based on the individual needs of the student. They could get maybe X amount instructional time, like outside of the classroom, where somebody will sit with them either in small group or one-on-one and work on, say, reading or writing or math. What they do is they have like another set of eyes in the classroom, so that if they struggle with the topic or something that they're not understanding or grasping, then that other adult can possibly spend time with that child or just any child in the classroom.
So your youngest are the ones that don't have this. And as you mentioned, it's just you for both of them. And I'm sure that you're keeping at least one or two eyeballs on the oldest ones anyway. I mean, how have you managed to stretch yourself so thin?
I haven't. I feel like I'm failing as a parent here and there. But ever since this, it's been like a regular. Like, I'm just failing. And I'm trying my best to keep my head above water.
Vicky, you're not. Yeah, you're not failing them. Believe me. They see you trying. They see you doing your absolute best. You're not failing them. Priya, what about you? Long Beach is also online. Tell us about you and your children's experiences so far.
We've been off to a pretty rough start as well, similar to what Vicky was describing, where I think at times I feel like I'm failing as well. So my son is a second grader with an IEP. My daughter just started middle school. She's now a sixth grader. And it was a very difficult adjustment for both of them, actually. They both were required to have a lot of screen time. So my son, a young second grader with an IEP, was expected to be on screen for about 6 hours a day when we started out. And his attention span is probably 2 minutes at best. So I would find myself basically sitting with him right next to him for the entire school day. Just trying to get through it. A lot of behaviors would come out of him, and at certain points he just broke down and he just really couldn't do it. And it broke my heart to watch him breaking down because, yeah, absolutely, I felt like a parental failure as well. I've since have worked with the school to modify that. So he's off of being online for such a huge amount of time. It's now limited. I was able to work out a specialized IEP for distance learning with our school. So a lot of his curriculum is now independent and I can work with him independently, but that means that I'm now wearing the hat of an educator and I am not a good educator. I'm actually absolutely terrible. I'm a lawyer. I'm much better as a lawyer than an educator. And I give credit to teachers for what they do so much because I really can't do it.
Priya, what about you when it comes to being wiped out, though? You mentioned how there are times where you spend your entire day next to your son. How much time does that leave for everything else that you have to do?
Not much time at all. I'm utterly wiped out at the end of the day. And that's actually when I start working, is when they're done. So it's taken a toll on my entire family. Absolutely. It's very hard.
Vicky, I know that you've brought in your niece to help you out. Has that offered any kind of relief for you at all?
It has. I first started on my own and I was doing what I could, but then she stayed with me for a little bit because she had to quarantine here. So when she was here for those 2 weeks, I noticed that the help, like, you know, she works full time and she works for a child development early education center. But when she gets home, she can help with, okay, is everything done? Because I do as much as I could. And then I got to worry about dishes or food or laundry or something else. Right. So she makes sure that whatever I didn't get to do with the kids, that, you know, she checks it off and makes sure they're prepared for the next day because there's a lot of printing material for the next day as well. So she helps in that aspect. You know, she picks up the ball after I'm done pretty much.
As I mentioned earlier, schools in LA County are accepting waivers from schools that wish to reopen. Right now, it would only apply to students in kindergarten through second grade. I'm wondering, Priya, is this an option for you? Should it happen? Why or why not?
I have been following that, wondering if that might be a feasible option for us. But unfortunately, it looks like Long Beach Unified wouldn't be acting on it anytime soon. They're doing it in stages. And my son would not be one of the prioritized students. He would be much later. They have like a step level approach to it. And I understand that. But totally unrelated to that too is just the health risks and how I'm nervous, actually still with the decision of whether or not I would have my son return back to school. I just don't feel safe and I don't know if the schools would be able to keep him safe. I have a lot of hesitation.
Vicky, what about you? Is this an option for you and would you like it to happen or not?
I also don't think it's an option for me because my older boys, I have discussed it with them. They're the ones with the IEP, so it would apply to them. And they've said, no, we're not going to go back unless everybody's going back. And they kind of are also wary about catching anything and bringing it home to me. So for the same reason that Priya says, I'm afraid not just for them, but for myself. And I think more so for myself as I have a compromised immune system. And if I can't take care of them, who's going to take care of them?
Right, Vicky, I know that you have a rheumatoid arthritis, and I at least some of the medication for that I know has to do with things that wreck your immune system. So you're particularly vulnerable in a situation like this for something to go wrong.
Correct. So it's so hard. I mean, even the stress of all of this, you know, inflammation is on a daily basis. I'm exhausted, but what can I do?
So in a way, Vicky, would it be fair to say if LAUSD decides to keep kids at home long term, that for you, that actually probably is the safest, best option?
Absolutely.
Priya, you mentioned how you're a lawyer, a special education lawyer. How has having to essentially be a teacher for your son impacted the work-life balance? You mentioned how as a teacher, you're not very good. Those were your words. You'd rather be practicing law. But I mean, is there a balance really right now?
There's no balance. I've tried so hard to figure out a way to make it work where I can do it all, but I really can't. I'm wearing too many hats right now. And my professional life has definitely taken a back seat, which is really hard because I work with a nonprofit and the families I serve are families who have very limited resources and they come to us for help and support. And I'm not able to do what I wish I could do because I need to tend to my own family's needs right now. So I've had to reduce by, gosh, I'd say more than half. I'm probably down to about 25% of my normal workload right now because I work in between what my family's doing. So I cannot really start working until my children log off with their schoolwork. But then there's still other things to do, like run the household. And I'm really wiped out. It's definitely wiping me out.
We're talking to parents Vicky Martinez and Priya Balsen about how the school year is going so far. They both have kids in LA Unified and Long Beach Unified schools, respectively. Now, you know, wondering how you both feel about how the schools have handled things so far. What are they getting right? What would you say is the one thing they're getting right? What would you say is the one big thing that needs to be improved? Vicky, let's start with you.
I think their hands are tied too, but I think they are trying their best. They're accessible. We had to get a new principal for my children's elementary school, and that principal's amazing in there. And she holds weekly assemblies and she sends out regular communication, which we didn't see that before. So I appreciate that if I need her or if I need any of the boys' teachers, that they're there and they know it's hard and it's hard on them. I wish we could help them more. And the same, I guess, holds for the middle school and high school, but then they're limited by the district and there's only so much they can do. But I appreciate that I could reach out to them and that they're willing to work with us however they can.
Priya, what about you?
We've been fortunate with the schools that my kids are at. I feel like the teachers are giving it their all. They're doing their best. But a lot of the issues are not from the school sites or the administrators. It is from the higher ups. It's from the district level. But we were able to get some support for my son when he was struggling with the high amount of hours online. We actually were able to have that IEP and sit down with his teacher and sit down with the principal who wanted to work with us to see what they could do to make it better for my son. And I'm greatly appreciative of that.
You know, one of the things about online learning that we've heard and I've talked with people about, and it makes sense. It's all about the kids, right? That's the whole point of why we're all doing what we're doing. It's all about trying to get the kids the best education possible and hopefully that they don't, you know, fall back too much. But for the parents, for you, Vicky, for you, Priya, if you could just tell people out there that maybe don't have this experience in their life, maybe they don't have kids, or maybe they're not in a situation where they know parents that have kids and parents that are going through this all at the same time, mixed in the same house. What would you say is the one thing you want people to know? Because, I can only imagine if this continues in the next year and the year after that we're going to have a whole lot of parents who are emotionally just chewed up from the inside out. And who knows what kind of person winds up showing up after that. So Vicky, let's start with you. What's the one thing you'd like people to know about everything that's going on with online learning and what it does to parents?
Oh my goodness, there's so much, but it's definitely hard. And I guess I would just ask patience. Like, things are so hard in general right now throughout the world, in our nation. So I would just say patience. You know, if I'm running to the store and I just need to grab something really quick, and I don't mean to cut you off, but if I happen to, maybe just don't flip me the bird. You know, something as simple as that.
Priya, what about you? What's the one thing you want people to know about what this is doing to parents?
I think it's an understanding of all the multiple hats that we're wearing right now. Being an educator, trying to juggle jobs, trying to juggle the household, that it's a lot on our shoulders right now. But I really think that one of the things I'm most disheartened about is the loss of opportunities that our kids are going through right now. And ultimately, at the end of the day, I just think about the kids and what they can't do right now, that they're now stuck behind these computers. That's how they're getting their education. They're not having the social interaction. They're not having the sports. They're not able to participate in band. They're not able to hang out with their friends during lunch. All those little things that they can't do breaks my heart, completely breaks my heart.
We just heard from Priya Balsun, a parent of two from Long Beach, and also Vicky Martinez, parent of four from Highland Park. Vicky, Priya, thank you very much and good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Staying with the education field, California's early childhood workforce is diverse, but research shows women of color are often concentrated in the lowest paying jobs in the field. KPCC's Mariana Dale reports on leaders paving the way for the next generation.
In 1991, Tashawn McKeithen was studying economics and sociology at Williams College in Massachusetts.
And thought I was, you know, going to be sort of the Wall Street type. I'm from New York.
Then a college internship landed her in a Brooklyn elementary school classroom teaching third graders how to read.
I thought to myself, very selfishly, like, I want to feel this way on a regular basis. I want to see this, you know, have this joy in my life and also just be able to give part of myself to someone.
McKeithen finished her bachelor's and went on to get her master's and a doctorate. She taught in New York City public schools and led numerous early childhood programs. This school year, she started as the executive director at the Child Educational Center, a nonprofit in La Cañada, Flint Ridge, known for its outdoor classrooms.
My favorite thing is when I see children just so happy, just playing in the mud and just allowed to be children. It's grand.
McKeithen is the first new leader of the center since its founding in 1979.
I am also an African-American woman, and I think there's not many African-American women who are here, but I own it and I let people know I'm speaking from this kind of perspective.
Comprehensive data about the early childhood workforce hasn't been collected in California in more than a decade. No one has a firm handle on the demographics of leadership in the field. But McKeithen's experience was familiar to Leah Austin. She heads UC Berkeley's Center for the Study of Child Care Employment.
You can walk into, you know, most policy and advocacy meetings in the field, and you can see very clearly that it is predominantly white.
The center is currently conducting a new workforce study. Austin says one of the barriers that prevents childcare workers from rising in the ranks is access to higher education. There are also fewer professional development programs for early educators compared to K-12. She interviewed early childhood leaders for her doctoral dissertation and found mentorship was a key to their success.
But it was only the leaders of color who talked about leadership of color, who talked about the need to diversify leadership and to name that very clearly.
Delia Vicente is the executive director of UCLA's Early Head Start programs. She says she benefited from supervisors who supported her ideas, and now she's trying to pass that on.
I'm constantly asking my team, what do you want to do when you grow up some more?
It's a question she borrowed from her young son. When he asked it about 5 years ago, it challenged her to start teaching and create more programs.
When somebody asks you that, then you go get it. Then you're like, okay, I'm motivated now. Now I know where I'm going.
For Tashawn McKeithen, accepting the role at the Child Educational Center felt like the next step in publicly advocating for early childhood programs.
How do we get people to rethink and reframe around early childhood education and remember how important it is?
McKeithen has also advocated for change within the places she's worked at. For example, creating an anti-bias curriculum. That experience stood out to the board, who all have or had kids attending the center. Katie Fallon Kenyon is the president.
She had talked about initiatives she'd done in other places to really start reflecting on an organization's diversity, equity, inclusion, and that's something we really want to embrace.
At the same time, McKeithen must also guide the center through a pandemic that's totally upended the childcare industry.
There's moments where I'm human and that I say, oh my gosh, I just can't move forward. And then I say, why am I here? Why am I doing this?
In these moments, McKeithen thinks not only about the children she serves through the center, but also her own daughter. She wants her to see how much one person can change. Covering early childhood, I'm Mariana Dale.
All right, heads up, in about 25 minutes, there's a statewide flex alert. And no, that does not mean sun's out, guns out, wearing a tank top time. No, a flex alert is when we all try to give our energy grid a break. A conversation on a conversation, a conversation on conversations. The next one, take two, continue. Stay with us.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of How to LA, a podcast that is a love letter to Los Angeles. Independent movie theaters are having a glow-up moment.
Vidiot's and Eagle Rock, amazing. We have our friends at the American Cinematheque. The Vista just reopened.
In our new series, Revival House, we'll take you inside these spots and share their history. Because movie history is LA history. Listen to Revival House on How to LA wherever you listen to podcasts.
Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org. I'm Ian Martinez. Yeah, it's hot out there. Temperatures all over California are high, and that's triggered a statewide flex alert starting at 3 o'clock, about 22 minutes from now. So who else do we turn to for some guidance but Sharon McNary, infrastructure reporter for KPCC. Now, Sharon, come 3 o'clock this afternoon, what do Angelenos need to do to comply with the flex alert?
Well, we've had a lot of them lately. A flex alert is a request for everybody to reduce their energy use as low as they can. That's to keep the state's utilities from running short and having to resort to the kind of rolling outages that we saw back in August. So the request from utilities is to set your air conditioning on this very hot day to a barely comfortable 78 degrees. They also want you to turn off unneeded appliances, avoid doing things like laundry, charging your electric car, or running the dishwasher until about 10 o'clock tonight.
10 o'clock. All right. Now, the California Independent System Operator, CAISO, issued the alert. What are they concerned about today? Make the connection to the weather for us, if you can.
Okay, well, it's hot out there. It's about 95 downtown LA, hotter in the valley, and it's following on a series of hot days and warm nights. When the weather doesn't cool down at night, people are running their air conditioning at night, so that creates an additional demand on the system, especially at sundown. It means the electrical transmission equipment doesn't have a chance to stop working and cool down, so there's the added chance it can cycle off, causing unplanned outages. But it also reduces the overall supply of power. And when it's hot across an entire region like this, Southern California utilities are competing with energy suppliers across the western U.S. to buy power. A lot of our power comes from very far away. So all these factors can cause the demand for electricity to outstrip the supply, hence the request to use less energy.
Okay. Now, last time we went through this period of extreme temperatures back in August and September, there were some blackouts, intentional rolling blackouts, mostly up north and not so intentional ones here. Remind us of the difference and whether any of it can be avoided this time around.
Well, back in August, it was Friday night, August 14th, we were in the midst of a five-day heat storm, and a lot of things happened to cause big utilities to impose these rolling outages on about a half million people. And a good amount of the outages were in Southern California Edison territory. 2 days later, there were other rolling outages for about 300,000 people. And Edison's portion of those outages was fairly brief, about 8 minutes. So what happened and why? Well, weather had been hot. Fires in Northern California were threatening to take down big power transmission lines that can bring power to the rest of the state. Also, the day before, utility power managers had failed to order up enough electricity generation to meet demand. Bottom line, the state's utilities imposed these rolling outages to reduce the demand, and it was the first time in 20 years. Now, there's some things going on now that exacerbate the problem. Climate change is making the region hotter and causing more of these heat storms and other weather extremes. And California's been trying to reduce climate change or deal with it by moving to cleaner energy. But that means that some plants that burn coal or gas have been taken out of service. So that last little percentage of energy to cover the heightened demand, sometimes it's just not available and we could run short. And that's why it's important to reduce energy use today for the Flex Alert. And if we don't turn it off, the utilities just might.
That's KPCC's infrastructure correspondent, Sharon McNeary. Sharon, thanks a lot.
You bet.
More than 8,600 structures have been damaged or destroyed in wildfires this year in California. And it's easy to forget that even as these fires are put out and we move on to the next one, that there are families who have lost everything. KPCC science reporter Jacob Margolis has a story about what it's like for one man 2 months after the Lake Fire.
It's really nice on Pine Canyon Road up in the hills above Palmdale. Backed up against Angeles National Forest, it's quiet and remote. The dry hills are dotted with trees and chaparral, and explored by rabbits, deer, and mountain lions. You can imagine it smells really nice. And it did, before August 12th.
It was about, I want to say it was 3:30, and my son's girlfriend came over. She knocked on the door. She said, you know, there's a fire and it's close. And I said, well, how close? She said, well, it's about 4 miles away.
Michael LaCroix lived in a trailer next to his son's house on a five-acre property. He'd moved in years ago, after a bad divorce, and since then he'd grown closer with his kid, who had a family of his own. Long term, Michael was thinking of moving to Nevada with his girlfriend, the dream always in the back of his mind.
Next thing you know, about an hour later, firemen show up, and I asked him, is this serious? And he said, well, we're just doing an assessment. But then I noticed that they were taking all the wood and flammables away from both of the houses, and I'm like, oh, this could be serious.
The Lake Fire had broken out about 2 hours before. Hot and dry wind gusts pushed it through crispy vegetation. Smoke built into a giant pyrocumulus cloud visible from over 100 miles away. At the property, 747s began flying low over the treetops, raining down red fire retardant on everything below.
They dropped all over our heads, all over the vehicles, all over the house. I was trying not to slip because it was so thick on the cement.
Firefighters told him it was time to go.
Really, it was just hard to think as we were trying to collect what was important. I mean, I grabbed like my hockey skates and my skis, and then I'm like, you know, Mike, it's probably more important things than those.
He packed his guns and some clothes, but in the chaos, forgot to grab some important documents and photos. He said he stopped on his way out the door, turned around, and took a picture of the living room. Not for insurance or anything, just to remember what life was like before he walked down the driveway and hopped in his car.
So, yeah, it was just watching the flames coming over the hill towards the house when I was driving away, knowing that, you know, I may never see anything again. And it was really mixed, the feelings. Part of me was saying, you know, the firemen are there. They're in the yard. There's probably 6-8 of them. They're going to save it. And then the other part of me saying, you know, you may not ever see these things again.
He drove down to Panda Express in Palmdale, ordered himself an Angus steak and walnut shrimp, sat in the parking lot for hours, thinking about what was next. That night, he crashed at his girlfriend's kid's house. And the next evening, after the fire had passed, he drove back up, darkness creeping in as he arrived.
Even a couple of miles before I got to the house, it just looked almost like a moonscape because everything, all the vegetation was gone.
The acrid smell of everything that had burned hurt his lungs. Not just wood, but plastic and metals and animals, unable to escape.
I pulled up the driveway and looked and saw that the houses were gone. That's when I called my son. So I just said, I've got some terrible news for you. I mean, there's really nothing left under there. It's kind of mind-boggling when a house burns to the ground like that.
The reality of the total loss began to set in. The Red Cross put him up in a hotel for a few weeks. And as he tried to get his bearings, his girlfriend Holly and her daughter set up a GoFundMe, something he said he'd never do.
People that I don't even know are giving. Holly, my sweetheart, she'll look at it and go, well, you look at what it's up to. And do you know so-and-so? No. Do you know this name? No. people just realizing that, you know, what a struggle it is to have something like this happen. But I'm just shocked.
That all helped with the smaller stuff, but getting money from his insurance company for bigger things like a new trailer has become a full-time battle over the past few months. I asked him repeatedly how he was feeling, and he surprisingly never really said bad. He said his messy divorce taught him not to focus on the negative, and that his growing devotion to God gives him faith that things are going to be okay.
It's not the end. It can be kind of a beginning, and it really just kind of hardens the resolve that there's going to be some changes coming anyway, because we had already planned it. And now it's just maybe with less stuff.
I'm Jacob Margolis.
More Take Two coming up in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
The journalists in the LAist newsroom work for you.
I'm LAist higher education correspondent Adolfo Guzman Lopez.
What the students are speaking about, it is extremely valid.
My reporting is about how students use higher education toward a better life.
For the first time since being in this campus, it made me feel unsafe.
Struggling through challenges like ethnicity, class, poverty, and family pressures.
LAist, independent journalism, fact-based journalism.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and on kpcc.org. I'm Ian Martinez. A few days ago, the Native American and Indigenous Writers Committee of the Writers Guild released an open letter to Hollywood. It was timed with Indigenous Peoples Day, but their message went way beyond that holiday. At a time when the country's going through a reckoning around race, representation, and inclusion, this group of screenwriters is telling the entertainment industry to stop erasing them from the narrative. Joining us are the co-chairs of that committee.
Hi, my name is Tazbaro Chavez. I am a citizen of the Bishop Paiute Tribe from the Diné, Numu, and San Carlos Apache tribes.
Hi, I'm Anthony Flores, Pyramid Lake Paiute and Washoe from Northern Nevada.
Tazba, Anthony, first, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today. I want to start with the motivation to write this letter, because as I read it, I thought, you know, this is something you guys could have been writing every single year going back decades. So why now? Tazba, let's start with you on that.
We felt inspired by a letter that the Black Writers Committee had put out in response to the murder of George Floyd and the racial reckoning that's happening currently in America. And so we had two members who brought it to our attention to say, you know, we should write a letter like this. And we gave it a lot of thought because we know a letter like this has been necessary for a long time. And at the time that the Black Writers Committee put out their letter, it was really important to us that we not take attention away from their cause, and we wanted to stand in solidarity with them. So we waited on our letter, really gave a lot of thought to what is it that we want to say to Hollywood, because the issues that we face are not the same as other communities of color. You know, each has their own unique experience with this industry. And it came also at a time where we were seeing some very conscious shows that were dealing with race who were still depicting us in these very stereotypical ways. And Anthony and I, also part of our job as co-chairs, is that writers will come to our committee looking for Native writers. And we are running into a lot of requests for consulting versus hiring writers. We were running into a lot of period pieces, the same trope of someone having a dream and now being led to an answer by a Native person. And so him and I really have like this first glance at the types of stories that are being written by non-Native writers in the industry. And so a lot of what is in that letter is in response to things that not only have been happening for decades, but also things that are very much happening in the last month or two.
We can look around at our committee in person or on Zoom and understand that Hollywood clearly does not get what we are. That's part of the frustration. That's part of what was motivating us to write the letter, because of what Tazba said about the requests that we get, and sort of, you know, we get frustrated looking around the table and noticing, hey, people are wanting to write shows and none of us of our experiences that we have right now are being included in those stories.
Tasa, but you mentioned that you saw a TV show that, a very conscientious TV show, actually, that still fell into those same old tropes about Native Americans. Which show was that?
The most recent show that I can name is Lovecraft Country. There was an episode, I believe it was episode 4, where there is an indigenous Two-Spirit person. And I gotta say, like, I love that show, and I was so excited for all of the racial commentary that exists in that show. It was such incredible storytelling. And when that moment came with this character in the last 10 minutes of that episode, I was like, man, come on. Like, it hit every trope that we have, which is that this character existed in a time capsule. They were a victim of horrific trauma. It was this combination of a lot of things that we talk about in the letter.
And Anthony, what are the lasting effects of those kinds of representations in movies and TV shows? Because I can only imagine that for the person that's watching that maybe doesn't think of things as deeply as maybe you and other people might think of things, they might just not really give that character its humanity.
Yeah, well, obviously, look at the mascot situation in the United States. There is literally no other race that is represented in a mascot as prevalent or as derogatory as Native people. I mean, the Indians' mascot is called Chief Wahoo. Even the name itself is a character of,
and the drawing is a cartoon.
And the drawing
it's actually a very, very just weirdly drawn cartoon. Yeah,
exactly. You know, I had a 12-year-old a few years ago ask me if I was born in a teepee. So it's like a lot of America draws their information from television. Unfortunately, you know, I would say our history books are written very plainly and easily absorbed by young minds. And then they go on TV and some of that lack of history that they're taught in school is then shown to them in a time capsule or one dimensionally. And so therefore that is how they see Native people and how they think of them.
Well, then going from how Native people are seen to how they're not seen, because the word erasure is used to describe how Native American and Indigenous people have been excluded from the entertainment industry. It's a word that goes beyond simply a lack of representation. You write that in UCLA's 2020 Hollywood Diversity Report, Indigenous representation on and off screen oscillated between 0% to non-existent in all categories. Tasma, what do you think accounts for that erasure?
I think what accounts for that erasure is that we are not in charge of telling our own stories. When we think about how TV shows and film are created and what we see on the other end is a direct reflection of who had that pen in their hand, who was at that laptop, who was at that table, who made hiring decisions, casting decisions, who was in that writer's room. And so when there are not Native people involved in that process, you either get no representation, meaning that we don't exist at all, or the representation we get is incorrect and therefore erasive.
We're talking to Tasma Rose Chavez and Anthony Flores. At the Oscars earlier this year, when filmmaker Taika Waititi won the Academy Award for Best Adapted Screenplay, he said this.
This is really great. And I dedicate this to all the Indigenous kids in the world who want to do art and dance and write stories. We are the original storytellers, and we can make it here as well. Thank you. Kia ora.
He said kia ora at the end there, which is a thank you in Maori. Anthony, what did that mean to you when Taika said that?
Yeah, you know, that's 100% it. I actually was thinking about sort of my experiences recently about Hollywood Westerns, you know, because I am from Nevada. I'm from the West. And so Westerns connect to me because of horses and because of the culture and sort of the toughness that has to come along with it. But at the end of the day, I thought about, well, I didn't grow up on Westerns. Why not? The first Western I think I ever actually saw was Dances with Wolves. And it's funny because while, you know, we can look at it through the lens now and say that it's problematic and maybe wouldn't be made exactly the same way today, there was a humanity of those Native characters that I saw as a kid. Seeing those actors, that is the perfect example of how Native content and Native people on screen directly impacted my path to becoming a TV writer and being in Hollywood in some sort of way. And so hearing Taika say that, it's 100% correct. Part of what has kept us Native people out of Hollywood is literally, you know, our reservations are out in the middle of nowhere sometimes. You go to Navajo Nation, it's gigantic, but the industry around it is nowhere near it. And so the only way to expose young Native kids is through TV and film and through these stories.
I want to know what you guys think of the reaction to your letter. What kind of reaction have you gotten, Tazba?
The reaction so far has been positive in my experience. I have had former colleagues from previous shows who have been responsive to the letter who are non-Native. And it really did make them think about being active in including Native and Indigenous voices at all levels of film and TV production.
Anthony, what about you? What have you seen and heard about the reaction to the letter?
Me personally, I didn't get quite the same response. And I think, you know, if you look at the, I was just pulling up, I went to look at the comments on the Deadline article, and you can see most people want to fall into the same idea that we're just complaining, that, you know, Natives are an extreme minority. And so therefore, you know, the representation is exactly right. So what I see, honestly, is just that same sort of mentality that we've been battling for a long time. So I'm very happy with the fact that there are people that are responding in a way that puts us in the room.
That's Anthony Flores and Tazba Rose Chavez, co-chairs of the Native American and Indigenous Writers Committee of the Writers Guild. Tazba, Anthony, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you for bringing us on to discuss the letter.
All right, if you missed any part of Take Two, just go wherever you get your podcast. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. There's a million and one ways to contact me. You can find me on Twitter at, that's at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. I remember my name. You can also email me, amartinez@kpcc.org. You can do that too. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two is back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.